From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events by the people who live there.
There's a dead deer on the side of the road. There's a cripple man standing over the deer, one crutch on the ground, the other one stuck straight up in the air.
I'm Taylor Robinson. And today, we have four stories where each of our storytellers learn a very valuable lesson.
Josh's personality began to change. He was a little bit distant, maybe even a little depressed. And weeks would go by before I would learn that he was taking prescription pills for fun. And it just completely altered him.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So, coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I am Taylor Robinson, the ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have four stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham at different ARC Stories events. They include a young man striving in vain for his father's approval, a couple whose relationship is defined by the purchase of a VW van, and an educator whose entire life trajectory is shaped by one of his students.
We all understand that we're all very unique. We each possess qualities and characteristics that make us completely different from everyone else in the world. But sometimes our strongest relationships are with people who also share some of our odd qualities. In other words, what normally sets us apart actually brings us together. And that is absolutely true for our first story, where the physical impediment of our two heroes would be seen by most people as this huge obstacle. But for them, it's a vast source of humor. This was recorded at an event we held last year at the Avon Theater, where the theme for the night was Down on Your Luck, Stories for Friday the 13th. Here's storyteller Justin Fisher.
I was raised at Route 1, Conahatta, Mississippi. It's a Choctaw Indian word that means dirty skunk. You talk about being down on your luck. For the rest of your life, you have to tell people you're from Dirty Skunk. But I am convinced that when you're down on your luck, there's no greater comfort than to have a friend who knows and understands what you're going through. God blessed me early in my life to find such a friend. You see, I was born with a condition called cerebral palsy. And when I was 3 years old, I went to a place called the Mississippi Crippled Children's Center. Mississippi was just as politically incorrect back then as they are now. And when I was there, I met my best friend. He was also 3 years old. His name was also Justin, and he had cerebral palsy just like me. And so, even though we lived on opposite sides of the state, our parents made sure that we grew up together. And then when we went to college, we roomed together. Now imagine answering the phone. Ring, ring, hello. Is Justin there? Which one? The one in the wheelchair. Which one? The good looking one. Oh, that's for you, right? We had a lot of adventures together, but probably my favorite is the time that Justin and I went deer hunting together. We had been deer hunting separately quite a bit with family or friends, but this was going to be our first trip together. Now, if you can imagine, having cerebral palsy, one of the most physically challenging things I do every day is to get dressed. And if you're going to be out in the cold woods for a long time, you dress in layers. Most of those layers start at your feet. Put on clean underwear, because mama told you to. Thermal underwear, insulated camouflage pants, thin socks, thick socks, insulated camouflage boots, all start getting on at your feet. And if you have cerebral palsy, your feet are way down there. And it was just one of those mornings where you're just yelling into the other room, are you ready yet? No, are you? No. So we finally get ready, and we go out to load up in my handicapped accessible minivan, the perfect deer hunting vehicle. Hydraulic lift that raises the wheelchair from the ground to the floorboard level, and then I transfer from my wheelchair to the driver's seat. I drive with hand controls. I have one hand on the steering wheel and one hand on the gas and brake. Let me pause here to say that if you meet me in the road, don't expect me to wave. I'm a little busy. It's very cold, it's very dark, and it's very foggy. Like driving through pea soup kind of foggy. Justin and I are joking and laughing, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this brown blur. And before I could say, think, or do anything, we were hit by a kamikaze deer. Do y'all know what the word irony means? Two cripple men have gotten up hours before daylight. They have dressed in camouflage head to toe to go out way out in the woods and hope that if you sit still enough and quiet enough for long enough, maybe, just maybe, a deer would come by that you could shoot at. But if you're in this really big machine that has a loud engine and lights, and you just drive down the road, deer will just come along and thrust themselves headlong in front of you. It is the irony of all ironies. So we pull over, and you do a quick assessment, just minor cosmetic damage. And now Justin and I have a decision to make. Do we go on out to our hunting spot and hope to kill a deer? Or just go back and get the one that's dead? Here's the other part of that. You see, Justin and I, whenever we had gone hunting separately, anytime we had killed a deer, we had to have someone that was with us bring the deer in. But this time, we had the opportunity to do it ourselves. As an aside, if you ever get a chance to help a handicapped person, one of the coolest things you can do is help them gain their independence. Because by helping them gain their independence, you have opened up the opportunity for them to have something that you couldn't give them, and that's dignity. And that's another irony, because what I'm about to tell you, there's nothing dignified about the rest of the story. We go back to the spot. There's the doe laying dead as a hammer on the side of the road. She had kind of slid down a little bank. So we got out on our forearm crutches, hobbling down, okay? nothing to use to pull with, so we pulled off our belts. One belt around the neck of the deer, the other belt around the hind legs, pushed and pulled and pushed and pulled, got her to the top of the bank behind the minivan. Opened up the back doors. But try as we might, we just didn't have the strength to get her in the back. So we did the only logical thing. We said, let's put her on the wheelchair lift and let the hydraulics do all the work. So Justin stays back with the deer, and I walk on my crutches, I get in the van, and I get in the six-way power seat, and I swivel around under the steering wheel. So, not wanting to run over the deer or Justin, I said, can you raise your crutch up in the air so I can see where you are? And he said, yeah, and he did. And about that time, I heard a car engine coming. Get in your brain what this car is about to pass. There's a dead deer on the side of the road with braided leather belts on her head and hindquarters. There's a cripple man standing over the deer, one crutch on the ground, the other one stuck straight up in the air. And he yells up at me, just act natural. I move the van. We got the deer on the lift. But with a wheelchair, two sets of crutches, a rifle, and all of our hunting gear, there was no room inside the van. So we had to leave her out on the lift and leave the lift out. Which meant to get back to hunting camp, we had to drive in the middle of the road so we wouldn't take out mailboxes on the way. We made it back, and we have a great story to tell. And here's hoping that when you are with your friends, you can all just act natural. God bless you. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it. Love you.
Justin Fisher is an author and economics instructor at Jefferson State Community College. You can learn more about him at his website, can'tevenwalk.com.
That Justin named his website Can't Even Walk highlights one of my favorite things about him. He obviously has a great sense of humor, but his self-deprecation catches you completely off guard. You're honestly not sure if you should be laughing along with him, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But what's so great is that it also totally disarms you. You know, you're never really tempted to laugh at him, but he knows that his life is pretty different from the rest of ours. So he invites people in to laugh along with him about those differences. It's fantastic.
That's one of the things that I love most about our ARC Stories events. The more popular they've become, the more people participate. And I just love seeing how stories from such different people, from such different perspectives and backgrounds, ends up bringing everyone together. And when that happens, it is like magic.
It is. And the reason is because any story that is told well, it doesn't matter what it's about or who the storyteller is, great storytellers have a way of relating their stories to the audience. And that is absolutely true for this next story, because it's a story about a little boy trying to make his daddy happy. We'll hear about it in just a moment. This is ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who lived them. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, story coach with ARC Stories. We all know what it's like to try to impress our parents. And some of us have it easy because it seems like they're supportive no matter what we do. For others, though, that is not the case. And that pressure is often never more burdensome than when you're on a sports field trying to please your dad. That weight definitely hangs heavy in this next story. It's from an event we did in partnership with the Birmingham Museum of Art and our friends at the Moth, where the theme was storytelling and Southern identity. Here's storyteller Ingram Wilkinson.
We haven't scored yet. The other team scored a goal on us really early in the first half, and despite the fact that it's now the second, despite the fact that time is running out, there's not much of it left, we know we can not only score, we know we can win. I'm playing the midfield, and I'm driven by a desperation to advance to the semifinal game and win this tournament with my team. When I think back on that moment, I can only remember standing in the middle of the field at this precarious instant and seeing my opponent, a midfielder in front of me, receive a pass far, far from the left of the field from one of his own defenders. And I see next to me an open space through which he himself might run and score a goal, ending and dashing all of our hope. This can't happen. I remember charging. I remember being propelled by the delusion that courage and not fear was driving me forward. And then the ball puttered out of bounds. I remember the sideline ref put down his flag and ran to retrieve the ball. And I turned to my opponent, who was now on the ground. He was bent over. He was breathing heavily. His eyes were shut. And I remember the main referee blowing his whistle, running over to me, pulling the card from his pocket and extending it high into the bald sky. When I was 12 years old, fearing that I was either insufficiently masculine or too effete, my stepfather struck a deal with me. $20 for every yellow card I incurred during a regulation soccer game. He made this arrangement with me in my kitchen, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you, I accepted. I was tired of being known to my family and myself and my teammates as someone who did not seem, because he was not, in fact, tough enough. I have very sensitive skin on my chest. And so whenever I played a game, my mom mandated that I wear these bandages to stop any chafing from happening during competitive play, and I was tired of being known as the 12-year-old who played t-ball who wore mom-mandated nipple protectors. I wanted more out of my adolescent life. After I shook my stepfather's hand, we were in our SUV driving from Trustville to Tupelo, Mississippi, one early day in May for an important regional tournament. We arrived, we played a qualifying game on Friday, we won, we advanced into the bright, humid Saturday I remember so vividly. The humidity was so dense, it threatened to surround and kill us and fossilize us within itself. I was doing my warm-up calisthenics on the field, staring across at my opposing team, and it was all there. The game hadn't yet started. I went over after I'd stretched to await the beginning of the game and took out of my soccer bag my water bottle and, looking down at it, realized my zipper was broken. And I looked up across the field at the parents I could see but not hear, and I looked at my bag, whose mouth was wide open, saying as they were, "Good luck. We believe in you. You're going to win. We love you." As I was staring down at my opponent, I looked over towards my coach and my bag, and he yelled out at me, "Take a knee!" Everyone else on the field had done that except for me. And so, still dumbfound, I'm on my knees, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm staring down now at the heaving, crumpled body of the person I myself have injured with my own body. And I can't bear to look at that, so I look up and I see a veritable sea of his teammates in their yellow jerseys staring at me with an anger that I at that moment felt inside of myself for myself. And unwilling at all to turn and look at my own teammates, I realized, aha, it's hot. It's logical to wipe your hand across your brow. Do that and close your eyes and go somewhere else. Don't be in this moment. And so my eyes are closed, and I'm wiping my brow with my hand, and this is supposed to be a comforting space. This is where I go. No one else gets to go there, and in that moment I can remember so vividly, it was unsafe. The presence of a boy I had injured, who was guilty of nothing but wanting to win in the way that I wanted to win, whose face was similarly sunburned. He was there in my head, and the only way I can begin to describe it then or now is to say that he had imprinted on my imagination some shadow of itself. It was, in fact, inseparable from the solace I had come to find inside myself, that new blackness that was as much a part of the light as it was divorced from it. People started clapping eventually, and I'm just on my knee with my eyes closed, and I open my eyes, and the boy has risen. He's up. It's triumphant. His coach had come over, run across the field out of worry, and he's standing. He's okay, and he walks to the sidelines. At some point, a whistle blew. At another point, I played the game as I had been playing it at the midfield, and at a point after that, we lost. And so I did what I knew to do, and instead of walking along the lines of my opponents saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I gave them a good high five as you're required to do in adolescent soccer, youth soccer, and I said, good game, good game, good game. Thomas Pynchon writes that the act of injury is in fact two-sided, that it involves the act of injuring and the act of being injured. I've thought a lot about that of late as I imagine the story as it was occasioned by tonight. And if that 12-year-old boy was here now, if he could be here, he would be my age. And I would say to him, dear opponent, dear enemy, I hurt, I am sorry. I'm sorry I didn't apologize to you that day. And more largely, more significantly, I'm sorry that I never thought to apologize for all the years since, that it took a night with an audience for me to even think of you again. I'm on the subject of you all and being on the stage supposed to say something about being Southern, as if a story about a young queer 12-year-old trying to play soccer aggressively to impress his parents and his peers was not quite Southern enough. And so I was thinking about being Southern, and I was thinking about all of the eyewitness testimony I got when I left the field, when I walked over to my parents and I asked my mom what happened, and she said, well, he ran up to you and you just put your elbow in his face. And I thought about the parent of a teammate of mine who said, yeah, you did that, but you also kicked his legs out from under him at the same time. And I thought about my stepfather who said nothing and did nothing until we stopped for gas in Tuscaloosa on our way home prematurely. And he went into the gas station, and he came out, and he sat in front of me in the passenger seat of our SUV, and he extended behind the seat the $20 bill that I took that I took and put into the still gaping maw of my soccer bag. I think in telling you this, that being Southern has everything to do with this notion of injury being two-sided that I've described for you. I think that when you were born in the South, you were born into an injury and not out of it. It's a very, very complicated idea, but one that I felt in my experience, and perhaps you felt it too. Perhaps you felt apologies that you've had to say glissandoing through your life. Perhaps you know or do not know something of having to be so overwhelmed that you fail to apologize to a boy who, again, was guilty only of doing what you yourself were trying to do. And perhaps you grow up, and perhaps you hurt some other people for whom you apologize, and perhaps one night when you're 23, your stepfather calls you, and you can't be bothered to talk. You're busy. You're busy. You're 23 now. And the next day, he dies. And perhaps you spend the rest of your time hoping for a day at which you might apologize for that, knowing that it's not going to come. I say all of this to you to say that if you're going to break, you had better break going out and not going in, as my opponent did. I say all of this to you, and I want you to imagine those moments for yourself. And then I want you to imagine sitting on that bench with your water bottle. And this game hasn't started. There's no timer running yet. Nothing's expected of you. You're there, and you're breathing, and you're 12. And then this whistle blows, and you know that something important is going to happen. And you know that you now have to get up and do something. And so you're standing there in your red jersey, well protected in the way that your mother ensured you were protected. And you look over, and you see your parents. And they're waving and gesticulating, and they're proud. And you see the parents of your opponents who are doing the same thing, almost down to the same motions. And you look at your team, and you look at your opponents, and you look at your coach, and you realize this is it. That here we are together. That there is, in fact, so much time left. Thank you.
Ingram Wilkinson is a coach and the communications director for Speak First, an initiative of AmeriCorps Impact Alabama. You can find him on Twitter at IngramW.
You know, it's rare for me to never hear a story before it's told in an event, but that was actually the case with Ingram's story. It was mostly because that event came quickly on the heels of another event that we were doing, and I wasn't able to connect with him ahead of time.
I heard it, though, at our rehearsal for the event, and I remember telling you that if he would just tell it exactly like he did at rehearsal, then it was going to be a great story.
Yeah, so the two things that struck me about it were both his vulnerability and his style. It was a very personal story dealing with some emotions, and he told it in such a way that it brought all of that stuff together just on a different level. And, you know, to me, it was just so awesome watching him connect so strongly with the audience.
Oh, definitely. But that's not always the case at our events. In fact, some of my personal favorites are when we have a first-time teller who conquers their nerves and bravely tells a deeply personal story like Ingram, though they might not have his experience. And that was the case with this next story. From an event we hosted at the Avon Theater where the theme was On the Road Travel Stories, here's storyteller Betsy Lee.
We had just gotten on the road. It was the weekend before Thanksgiving in 2008, and we had a long trip ahead of us, not quite 57 hours, but we were headed from southern Florida, and we were going to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So this trip began a couple weeks back. Josh called me at work to say he had found the perfect vehicle that he wanted to buy online, a 1972 Volkswagen Westphalia, a camper bus. Now, for anybody who can't quite picture what that looks like, it's one of those vehicles that the traveling hippie festival goer will probably purchase. It's a van, it's vintage, the top opens up so that you can like have standing room, there's a kitchenette, there's a back seat that turns into a bed. So, pretty cool. Anyway, when Josh called me at work to tell me about this vehicle, I was like, okay. Just another big dream for him. He's already called me to say, hey, let's drive to Philly, an hour and a half away for a slice of pizza. Or, I think we should take a destination vacation, get married, and not tell anybody. So for me, having him call me to tell me about a vehicle he wanted to buy online didn't really faze me. Till I got home from work, and he had a presentation all ready for me. Email correspondences, pictures, and he began by telling me, it's only $3,000. I had my own set of questions, like, okay, so if the bus is in Florida and we're in Pennsylvania, how are we getting that home? And you're asking me to send a stranger we've never met $3,000. What if we get to Florida and there's no bus? And what if we get there? There is a bus, but the pictures and the bus don't match up. I mean, I'm on social networks, stuff like that happens. But before long, we purchased one-way tickets and we were headed to Florida. Plane lands, we hail a taxi, we're on the way. And it's one of those moments where your heart is racing so fast and you're like, you just can't help but smile. I mean, that was until we got closer. And then I began to pray. Dear Jesus, please don't let that be our bus. Please let our bus be hidden around the corner. Well, my prayers and the taxi driver, they both failed me as we were dropped off a foot away from the rust bucket that soon would be ours. Well, in that moment, not only were my limbs frozen in place, my mouth would not move, and I could witness Josh handing over our deposit. A deposit that would have bought 2 plane tickets back to Pennsylvania. In that moment, I cried inside, and Josh named the bus Maggie May. Now, there were things I loved about Maggie May. Her interior was super rad. It was lime green and bright orange, and it was plaid. And even though the seats had holes in it, there were Sex Pistol patches to cover all the holes. She had this really cool smooth wood ceiling. But my favorite part was how she smelled, because the smell of her interior reminded me of the pop-up camper that my grandparents had that our family would take camping when we were children. So that was just a really cool moment for me. Well, they were really cool moments until the horn started honking. Every time the steering wheel slightly turned left, she would honk. Sometimes they were little honks like, beep, beep, beep. And then sometimes they just wouldn't stop. Meep. I did think, okay, we'll remedy this. We'll just turn on the radio. But that's when I realized that, we didn't have a radio, didn't have an 8-track, didn't have a cassette player, we didn't have anything. Before we got too much further, we did decide that it would probably be wise to pick up some water and some snacks so we could keep stopping to a minimum. So we finally got back on the highway, and I realized I can see the street through the floor. Normally in cars nowadays, there's like gaskets or, I don't know, something that goes around pedals so that you can't see the earth below you. Not Maggie May. So our list was quickly growing. We soon would realize that we also didn't have any turn signals. So the two of us are literally flailing our arms out the windows. I'm quite certain people were wondering if we were trying to take flight or actually signal which direction we were going. So we're going along, kind of like getting excited now, sort of liking this stupid tin can. And the sun starts to set. And I'm like, man, it's getting real cold in here. Got to turn on the heat. Well, evidently when they took out the radio, they took out the heater too. So we're driving along, chilled to the bone. 3 o'clock in the morning, we decide we're going to have to make a stop. So we stop at Walmart, buy a layer of clothes, put on the clothes we're already wearing, keep us from freezing to death. It was an adventure. But I very vividly remember at shortly after 5 in the morning, seeing the sun on the horizon. Again, I began to pray, thank you, Jesus, for the sun. Thank you for keeping us alive. Thank you for keeping me from killing Josh, because Mama wasn't happy. So I no sooner finished my prayer of thanks, and everything went quiet. The van coasted to a stop. My only instinct was, check out the motor. So I run to the back, open up the hatch, and literally before my eyes is the 4th of July firework display spewing out our engine. I was like, Josh, the bus is on fire! To which he runs out of the bus with our half gallon of water, throws it on the engine, and we are both standing there staring at our vehicle that's supposed to safely take us home. Smoke out. It was a long walk. We had about a mile to the nearest truck stop. It was a very quiet walk. We didn't have much to say to each other. We got to the truck stop, to which we now are coming up with another plan. We're notifying our parents what had happened. Tow truck eventually gets to us. We load Maggie May up on a trailer, rent a truck, and now we're headed back home. And it's the first time in the entire trip that I actually believe I'm going to make it home safe. I also think, well, if Josh and I can get through the life and the death of Maggie May, we can get through anything, right? Truth is, it's not how that relationship ended. few months later, after Maggie Mae was safely home, Josh's personality began to change. He was a little bit distant, maybe even a little depressed, and weeks would go by before I would learn that he was taking prescription pills for fun. And it just completely altered him. I was hopeful for him because I knew his love for life. I knew his love for adventure, and I had seen him in his life enjoying it, and I knew how happy he had been before the drugs. I could never forget the call on January 4th, 2010, when Josh's parents called to tell me that he had passed away late in the night. The breath escaped me. I felt like I was standing on that empty highway staring at a burning bus all over again. This time was different because I didn't know what to do. There was no water for this fire, and this wound would burn for a very long time. New questions formulated in my mind, things that to this day I just don't know the answers to. We eventually learned that Josh passed away of a drug overdose. But I could never forget Josh. Every time I see a Volkswagen, I think of him. And every time I see a camper bus, I can't forget that. But it makes me remember how Josh could look at that bus and he could overlook the rust, he could overlook the spray-painted exterior, and he could overlook the honking horn. And he could see Maggie Mae for what she was. And I guess in the end, I overlooked an awful lot about him because I saw what he could have been too.
Betsy Lee is the Service Programming Director for Redstone Church here in Birmingham. You can check her out on Instagram at TigerLily13.
We are always saying that we believe everyone has great stories and that anyone can tell a story well. And Betsy perfectly proves that. This was her first time to ever tell a story at one of our events, first time to really do anything like this. But it didn't matter. Everyone immediately connected with her because of her willingness to just share this story from her life.
And that's what I love about our live audience at the events, as well as our radio audience. You love good stories, and you want our storytellers to be successful. We are all on the same team. There is no antagonism, and we're always ready to go wherever our storytellers want to take us.
That's right. And in our next story, the storyteller takes us to a place that most of us just can't understand. And he discovers what life was really like for one of his students. That's in a minute on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm ARC Stories director Taylor Robinson. Most of us can't point to one story in our life that illustrates the moment that changed the entire trajectory of where we were going. However, that is precisely what our next story is about. It was recorded at the Avon Theater where the theme was Back to School, Stories from Around the Classroom. Here's storyteller Marshall Pollard.
So I knew I was going to be an educator for the rest of my life when I realized just how different I was from Ronald. See, Ronald lived in the housing community just down the street in Southtown. I got to know Ronald because I helped run an after-school program in that community for a number of years, and I also learned that I was very similar to Ronald. I mean, I looked a lot like him. I enjoyed some of the same music he enjoyed. We ate a lot of the same food. We played ball with one another after school in between tutoring. And we had the same dream. When I was eight, I also wanted to be a professional basketball player. But the difference that I learned that I had between him and me was when he came to after school and he had handwritten homework from his school. And it read, and I quote, "Ronald had him 45 cents. And Ronald went to Munchies, which is a store down the street, and bought him a soda for 32 cents. How much did Ronald have left? And I know there's so much that goes into that, understanding that homework, right? And why that there's differences, that he couldn't even read that homework. And I knew that in that moment, yes, there were differences between Ronald and me, and I wanted to do whatever it took to play my part to ensure that Ronald realized the limitless potential that he had, and that this was a lie. This experience that I was having in that moment was a lie, and I wanted to figure out, what could I do? What role do I play in ensuring that Ronald realizes his limitless potential? And so this set me on a journey, and I realized that I wanted to teach, and the only way a business and a sociology major can teach is through an alternative teaching program. And so this program led me to Washington, D.C., and I was a third grade teacher in D.C. public schools. And there are so many lessons that I could tell you about the experiences that I had that allowed me to learn how to bridge the world between me and my students. But the best story, the moment that changed my life, is the moment that I was sitting in Bishesh's dining room table. And like a good Tarantino movie, I've got to go backwards and tell you how I got there, right? And so, as I mentioned, I was a third grade teacher in public school and DC public schools. And as many teachers in this room will tell you, it's the hardest profession in the world. It's especially difficult when you're teaching in the nation's lowest performing school district, which DC was at that moment. Relationships in my classroom were pretty shaky. And teachers will also tell you that's the key. You got to know your kids. You got to believe in them. You got to trust them. You got to use relationships in order to make sure that they're achieving their potential. And so I didn't have the best relationship with my students, but a relationship I did have that was really strong was between me and Mr. S. Mr. S was also, he's a male, obviously. He's a man of color like me. So we had a lot of things in common, not just that, but we also love sriracha. And he would routinely, he was a great teacher, and he'd routinely come into my classroom, observe me, give me feedback, trying as a first-year teacher to be a good teacher. He'd give me this feedback, and it was really meaningful. He taught me everything I know about being a teacher. But it was in this moment, Kayla is in the back throwing pencils, cursing me out, laughing at me because I have no control of this classroom. And his kids are next door, and he's in my classroom observing me. And my kids go to lunch, and I walk over to his classroom, and I'm like, dude, like, how do you, you've been doing this for really long, like, how do you do this? Like, I'm ready to quit. I'm not going to quit, but I'm ready to quit. And while you're in my classroom observing me, like, your kids are self-monitoring their progress on an objective that you gave them while you're in my classroom attending to what sounds like recess. And like, so how do you do this? And he just looks right at me, and I'll never forget it. He said, man, if you don't realize that your kids spend 85% of their time away from the classroom, that their parents are their first teachers, and if you don't leverage that every single day in your classroom, it doesn't matter what you do. And so I set out on a mission of doing home visits for every one of my students, making sure that what was happening in that 85% was coming to the 15. But as I mentioned, this is about Bishesh and that dining room table. So I got to tell you about Bishesh. He's an immigrant from Nepal. He just immigrated. He and his family just immigrated to D.C. just over a year ago. So he doesn't speak much English. But the moment I met him, and my only memory of Bishesh is with a smile on his face. And he walked into my classroom, his eight-year-old, pants up to here until I told him, bro, that ain't cool. but, you know, he's this happy kid. He's always smiling. And because he doesn't speak much English, he's always drawing. He's a gifted artist, limitless potential. He's always drawing to express himself. And he always would do this thing, which at the beginning of the year was annoying, but then it became kind of sentimental, and he'd always follow me around the classroom and tap me on the shoulder and say, like, hey, look, look, you know? It's like, this is math, but this is a drawing. And that was his way of doing multiplication and division. But the memory I have of that describes Bishesh and his ability was when we were doing autobiographies in my classroom, and we were telling our story and comparing it to a civil rights leader somewhere in the world. And so he drew his story immigrating from Nepal to D.C., and he was comparing himself to Mahatma Gandhi and his journey along the Salt Sea. He's eight, and I was like tapping me on the shoulder to show me that, and he goes, I have a voice. And I was like, you get it. Like, you get it. That's awesome. And so with that in mind, this joyous kid who's got a story, who's got a voice, this is the things that I'm thinking about as I'm anticipating visiting his home and this dining room table, trying to bridge this world between me and Bishesh. But 2 weeks before his home visit, I get an email, not a letter, not a let's sit down as a faculty. I get an email from our administration saying that our school was shutting down. And it was because the leaders of the school had been laundering millions of dollars. They had created a nonprofit company to be the facility managers of the school. They were laundering millions of dollars and they got caught. And so our school was shutting down. And this was right before I was visiting Bishesh's home. So I'm walking, I'm riding my bike to his apartment. I'm carrying that with me, but I'm balancing it off with this really excitement because this kid's so joyful, right? And I ride my bike up to his apartment. I meet his dad in the main area near the stairwell. And I remember him being barefoot. And I remember that being so normal. And I walk into this 400 square foot apartment. And I'm overwhelmed with what I later find out is the smell of goat curry and more types of rice than I knew existed. And so I go and I sit down at his dining room table, which also serves as his bed. And it's adjacent to his mom and dad's bed. And out walk from the only other room besides the bathroom, out walk the matriarch and the patriarch of the family. They all immigrated to Washington, D.C. together. So we're sitting there, and I'm really excited because I get to hear their stories. Home visits are not punitive. They're not, I'm going to tell you what your son's doing in my classroom, and it's a checkup. It's, how can I take this and bring it back? And so I'm sitting there between the world and me of all these stories of how they got here. And it goes like this. They left Nepal in a small village to come to D.C. because they wanted to have a better life for Baraj, his older brother, and Bishesh. And they immigrated specifically to Washington, D.C. because they knew that being in the nation's capital, the most powerful city in the world, their access to services in the nation's capital would grant them citizenship quicker than a smaller or a city elsewhere. And they immigrated to this specific neighborhood because the school that I was teaching at had three Nepalese families, and they knew that that small community of people would be a safe haven for their kids. So they're telling me all this, and I'm realizing that at some point, we're going to talk about it, right? And so then they ask me, Baraj is, he's in fifth grade, he's going to sixth grade next year. What schools in this neighborhood do you think that he could go to so that Bishesh can stay at your school and you can watch over him? So here I am, again, between the goat curry and the 400 square feet and the floor I can now feel sitting on the bed. I tell him, our school is shutting down. Bishesh won't go to school there next year. And what was, you know, smiling faces immediately turned to fear, and it looked a lot like anger because the school hadn't said anything. They only said something to us, and I knew that they hadn't said anything to families, but really, I didn't have a job next year. I didn't care. And I wanted to tell them what the school should have told them and what the school should have never even done. And so as we began to discuss options, I realized there was really nothing I could do. I mean, there's nothing in that apartment that I could do. So after we finished the tea, I left. I shook hands with everybody and left. And this is a Wednesday, and I have to go back to school Thursday and see Bishesh again. But I leave his 400 square foot apartment and ride my bike 3 miles down the road to our $2,000 a month 400 square foot apartment, and I am overwhelmed with the world that is in between Bishesh and me. And it was in that moment when I got home that I realized that there shouldn't be a world between me and Bishesh. This is my world. His story is my story. His journey is my journey, and it should be. And there are so many reasons that this world exists that makes it a world between him and me. But the reality is, this is my student. His future has a lot to do with me. And so for the next 4 months, although my administration was very upset that I said something, I didn't care. And I went for Bishesh and other students to different schools in the community that were good for the whole family. And in that year, Bishesh grew 3 years in reading, and he now speaks more languages fluently than I do. And he and Baraj are doing okay. They're at the same school. And after my school shut down, I decided that being an instructor wasn't for me, that doing whatever I could to figure out how to bridge this world in between students and me by being further and further convinced that this is our world. Our kids are our kids. There is no difference between Baraj's future and mine. And so now I get to go to work every day to make sure that, you know, students and parents and teachers and residents and folks like you and me treat our kids as our kids. And that's what I'm convinced to do. So do me a favor. Follow me around, tap me on the shoulder, and make sure I keep doing that.
The teacher is teaching the golden rule.
Marshall Pollard is the Director of Community Partnerships for the Birmingham Education Foundation. You can learn more at edbirmingham.org.
You can't be around Marshall for long without noticing his passion and enthusiasm for his job. And that passion is actually really contagious. Hearing his story, it motivates me to want to get up and do something too.
With that being said, we would love to hear what your passions are. You can do that by visiting our website, arcstories.com, and clicking on the story portal. We'd also very much love to have you at our next live event, which is February 27th at the Avon Theater, where the theme for the night will be Crazy Little Thing, stories about love and relationships. You can find all the details and even purchase tickets at arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Adkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon, Leonard Lee Smith, Nate Dreger, and Jake Brantley for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, stay up to date on all of our events, and even submit your own story. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?